Right now, nice to see you all, folks. I thought, well, but this is an entertainment. This lady was married to an entertainer, so I thought I'd tell you a nice story about my mouse called Elvis, who's died. He got caught in a trap. Oh, never mind. Oh, forget it. Great. Well, Fiona, a joy to meet you yet again, because a few months ago we bumped into each other in Welshpool.
That's right, yes, all the best places.
Great. Now, I was very surprised to hear that Roy was a northerner. Well, I knew he was a northerner, but from Yorkshire.
Yes, unfortunately, he was born on the wrong side of the Pennines.
And you were born near Liverpool.
Yes, I'm afraid so, yes. It was a bone of contention right the way through our marriage. You know, the Wars of the Roses existed all the time.
Okay, great. Now, what age was Roy when you met him and this actual coming together was interesting? And it was all to do with Mr. Morecambe, Eric Morecambe, who said, this is Fiona, she's madly in love with you, and left you to it. So tell us about that.
You've told the joke now.
I didn't think it was a joke, but go on.
Well, it's a long story, really, because, as you said, I was born on the Wirral, and I went to a boarding school to train as a dancer down in Surrey from the age of 9, and I wanted to be a ballerina, but I never made it. And instead, I went into the sort of a musical theatre, starting off in summer seasons and pantomimes, as you did in those days. Does anybody remember what summer seasons were? Because they don't happen very much now. They were variety shows that functioned all around the coast of Great Britain in the summer. And so I started in the chorus, just dancing, and then sort of graduated to principal girl in pantomime and what they call soubrette in summer season, which was singer, dancer, take part in the sketches and things like that. And it was great. And I think there was about the first pantomime I did after I left school was at the Coventry Hippodrome. And in those days, it was the longest pantomime in the country, longest running. It ran until April. Can you believe that now? Pantomime running till Easter. Anyway, the top of the bill was Harry Secombe, and second on the bill were Morecambe and Wise. And Eric and Ernie were sort of quite well known in the variety side of the business, but they hadn't started to do the television, so they weren't that famous by then, but they were lovely. And I got to know Eric really well and his wife, Joan, and they had two little children at that time. And I did summer seasons with them and so on after that. So I maintained a friendship with them over the years. And it was on one of these occasions when they'd invited me to stay the weekend at their home. And we were all sitting down watching television. And Roy happened to come on the television. And he made a name for himself by this time. Incidentally, he made a name for himself. He always attributed his success to Prince Philip, because he'd been in the business since he was 14. He started sort of as a little amateur at the age of 8, and with a little group of people. And the whole show went professional when Roy was 14. And he carried on from there, but he didn't get known until a lot later than that. And then he was invited to do the Royal Variety Show. And he was carrying on. Nobody was taking much notice of him. And suddenly Prince Philip laughed at him from the box, the Royal Box. And so everybody looked up at the Royal Box and laughed. And suddenly he was Flavour of the Month, you know, and he was in every newspaper the following day and so on. So anyway, I'd seen Roy at the Palladium after that. And I thought he was incredibly talented. So I just said to Eric in a very stupid moment, oh, if ever you do a show with Roy Castle, can I come along? I'd love to meet him because I think he's so brilliant. And he just said, right, love. And that was the end of the story, so I thought. And it was a lot later, a few years really, I think, when he phoned me and said, hey, I'm doing a television with Roy on Sunday. Do you want to come along? Oh, yes, please, I said. And in those days, television was all live, and this was being done at the Wood Green Empire in London. And I went along, and as you've already said, Eric took me into Roy's dressing room, to introduce me, and he just said, "Roy, this is Fiona, she's in love with you," and walked out, left me. Left me blushing up to the roots of my then blonde hair, wanting to die. I mean, what can you say after that? I was very shy, and Roy was actually very shy, so we just looked at each other like idiots. What I didn't find out until Roy knew me well enough to tell me was that Eric had said to him that day, "Roy, will you do me a favor? I've got this little fan coming to see you. She really thinks you're great. She's a bit of a sad case, but be nice to her." She's got braces on her teeth and pigtails, but be nice to her. Right. Eric, he didn't mind what he said to anybody. You can imagine that, can't you? I mean, that's why he said what he said to Roy.
Okay. Now, Fiona, you were born where?
I was born in West Kirby, as I said, on the Wirral, yes.
Right.
When I say that, people say, "Oh, that's the posh part," because it's over the other side of Liverpool, but wasn't very posh, actually. Okay. And my father was Dr. Dixon, as you now know, because that was my maiden name.
Now, going into the world of entertainment, I mean, even now he's very precarious, unless, of course, you win Britain's Got Talent or whatever. Which,
well,
of course,
makes it even more precarious, doesn't it?
So, did your family sort of like the idea that you were into this entertainment scene and performing, or was it just what you're going to do, full stop, or did you have other ideas?
I think my mother was really pleased about it because she was the one who she talked to my dancing teacher when I was a little 5-year-old. And my dancing teacher had said I showed talent or something. Mm. And so they discussed how I could progress with this talent, and that's why I was sent to this boarding school. I think my father thought that if I could get it out of my system, I might get a proper job.
What age would he have sent you there, or would you have gone there?
What?
What age did you start the boarding school?
I started at the age of 9, yes.
And that meant leaving home and going south?
250 miles, yes, from my home. But I loved it because I just loved dancing. My parents sacrificed a lot, actually, in order to be able to send me there. Hmm. So it was a huge privilege to be able to be there.
And how many years would you have been there for?
I was there from 9 until I was 17. When I was 16, I did a pantomime. The very first show, they used to sort of release us from school to get some experience.
In the real world.
In the real world. And so I went into pantomime at the Worthing Connaught Theatre. And my parents came down on Christmas Eve. It opened on Christmas Eve. Mm. And they came down so that they could spend Christmas with me. And I think my father thought after, you know, I'd done the first night that I'd actually think, no, this isn't for me. And I think he was hoping that. Mm. But I was completely starstruck after performing the first time. And he just shrugged his shoulders and walked away, thought, well, there's no hope for her. Mm. Left me to it.
And did you have any brothers or sisters who...
I did. I had two sisters and a brother who are much older than I was. My next sister up is... she's 10 years older, and my brother was 13 years older.
And did they encourage you in the entertainment business?
They didn't
or?
Really care.
They were just brothers and sisters.
Yeah, that's right.
Great. So you went to the south of England, you trained us in the world of entertainment. When would you say, Fiona, you got your sort of big break, if I can put it like that, in the sense that you got a ongoing sort of permanent, maybe contract or whatever you had?
I don't think I ever did, really. I mean, I never did very well. I did shows that I absolutely loved doing. I was very fulfilled in the work that I did. Mm. And I was in several musicals. And the last show that I did before I got married, which is when I gave up show business, was The Sound of Music. Do you remember the sound? The real sound, the original.
With Julie Andrews.
No, that was the film.
That was the film.
No, and, this was 1961.
Wow.
I understudied the part of Liesl, who was the 16. Right. I am 16, going on 93, you know that one. And then she left to get married, and then I took over from her. But up until that time, I understudied various parts as well as Liesl. Mm. Well, that was my main objective. But I was also a nun. And so Roy's claim to fame was that he married a nun.
So I guess your big break was meeting Roy and then getting married to Roy.
It was really, yes.
Because you probably supported him so much in all.
Well, it was interesting because at that particular time, Roy was doing very well in the United States. He was doing lots of television shows and things like that over there and working in Las Vegas and places. And so we discussed it and I thought, well, there's not much point us being married if I'm working in London, doing shows in London and he's over in America. So I was very happy to give up the business at that time.
And you travelled then? Yeah. Mm. Did you not find that sort of existence a bit tough? Probably a different hotel each week, etc. How did you?
Well, but with Roy, once we were... No, it was fantastic. I was going to places that I'd only ever seen on maps. I was a starving dancer without two pennies to rub together. So it was really exciting for me to be able to go and see these places. And I mean, we didn't live luxuriously. We had a little flat in London, in New York, or an apartment. It was only a bedsit, really. But it was wonderful. It was really exciting for me to live in New York and visit all these places.
Now, of all Roy's talents, of which there was many, if you were summarising him in terms of his abilities, because he could tap dance, he could play music, etc., what was his great strengths?
It's difficult to say that, isn't it? Because I think the fact that he was so versatile and was able to turn his hand to so many different things was his strength. Now, they accepted that and loved it in the United States. Mm. They enjoyed versatility, as it were. But over here, everybody kept saying, well, what do you want to be? Do you want to be a singer or do you want to be a dancer? Or, you know, are you going to be a musician? Can you make a decision? And of course, Roy couldn't because he enjoyed doing all of those things. So I think that was to his detriment, really. But as far as I was concerned, I don't know. I probably enjoyed his dancing because I enjoyed dancing myself. And all the other things were very noisy. I mean, our home was very noisy. I think one of the funniest times was one Sunday. I was getting Sunday lunch ready. I was standing at the kitchen sink peeling the potatoes. And suddenly I heard this terrible noise issuing from the sitting room. It was sort of, sounded like a cow in labor as far as I was aware. I thought, what on earth's going on? So I went rushing in to the sitting room to find out what was the matter. And there was Roy, he'd bought himself a set of bagpipes and he was teaching himself to play the bagpipes.
Now, he's really, really well known for record breakers. And did that idea come from Roy, or was it like the Beeb or the ITV saying, we want you to do this, Roy, because of his personality, or did he sort of dream it up himself?
Well, it was an interesting thing, really, because he used to be on Blue Peter on occasions. If ever they wanted anything wacky or odd or stupid, they used to invite Roy to take part, you see. Mm. Alan Russell was the director of Blue Peter at that time, and he suddenly had this idea of record breakers, you know, the Guinness Book of Records, and seeing if it could become a television program. So they sort of did a tryout, thinking it might just be one season. And Roy was asked because Alan knew Roy's ability to turn his hand to all sorts of different things, as he'd done. In fact, Blue Peter, his one claim to fame was that he was the only person ever to be bitten by Shep. Do you remember Shep?
Yes, get down, Shep, get down, yes. Shep.
Roy had to play the spoons. He was playing the spoons. And Shep didn't like these spoons, so he came and bit his leg. So Roy was really proud of that. But anyway, Alan talked to Roy and said, would he be interested? And the McWhirter brothers were really keen for that to happen. And so they did this one program, and it actually lasted 22 years.
And when he was sort of walking on the top of wings on aeroplanes, as they were at so many thousand feet, I mean, how did this... Because it was quite a precarious lifestyle, and you probably didn't know what idea was coming next. So Fiona, when he was away and these things may take place, did you ever fear for him a little bit?
Well, the older he got, the crazier he became, you know. And the way Alan Russell used to ask him if he would do things made him out to be a wimp if he said no. Oh, so he always said yes to anything that Alan asked him to do, including wing walking across the channel. And I think he said that the scariest thing that he ever did was the death slide from the top of Blackpool Pier, Tower, sorry, down to the beach, which was a third of a mile. And he had to climb out from Blackpool Tower. And he had this figure of eight rope that he had to put his hands through and hold on to go down. And they had to soak this figure of eight rope for 24 hours in water, because otherwise it would have burnt through before he got down to the bottom. That's how it was. I mean, he did have a safety thing, but he said that just actually stepping over was probably the scariest thing he ever did. I think from my point of view, the scariest thing was that he had to parascend under all the bridges of the Thames and break a record. And I was terrified that the driver wouldn't slow down sufficiently and he'd be decapitated. But he actually said he was far more worried about going under the water of the Thames and drinking it, because he thought that would kill him anyway.
Have you sort of saved some of these pictures, and do you ever look back on them or watch them at all?
I've got one or two. They're all on video, and I keep promising myself that I'll have them transposed onto DVD, but I haven't done it yet. But I have got a sort of little DVD of bits and pieces of his various shows that he did, and so I do see them occasionally.
I remember the twins, the McWhirter twins, and one of them tragically was killed by a terrorist bomb, wasn't he?
The IRA, yes.
Did that affect Roy? I mean, was he very close? I guess he was.
It was an extraordinary experience for Roy, actually, because that particular day, Bruce Forsyth had been taken ill, and he was doing the Generation Game. Does anybody... You remember the Generation
Game,
it's
a good
game,
we do, yeah.
And Roy... Roy had to take over at like a minute's notice. They asked him if he'd come and take over, because again, that was live, it was done live. And so Roy went to it was being done in a theatre near White City, and Roy had to go and do this show. Meanwhile, Ross McWhirter was murdered by the IRA during that evening. It was a very nerve-wracking thing for Roy to have to do this programme, because he had no rehearsal or anything. He just literally had to go on and do it. And then they couldn't tell him what had happened, because he would have gone berserk, you know.
Yes.
And they had to tell him at the end of this show.
Yes.
And he had to have escorts. And he, for months after, Roy had to keep his car, you know, safe, and had to have lots of police looking after him and things like that, because he was connected with Ross. So it was a very tragic time.
Fiona, as a youngster, did you go along to church? Did you have a belief in God? And what was Roy's take on everything? Because I'd imagine that life was just fantastic with what he was doing.
Yes. So. Well, I was born at the beginning of the war, the Second World War.
Of course.
Just in case there was any doubt. And, do you know, I think in those days, most people believed in God and went to church and said their prayers, and we had assemblies with a hymn and a prayer and maybe a Bible reading every day. And then when I went to this boarding school, it was a very high Anglican church school, and very strong emphasis on religion right the way through. And so I felt that I was a Christian all the way through my life, really. I, you know, continued to go to church. We were married in church. We had our children christened. We tried to tick all the boxes.
Right.
That's the way I describe it, really.
So both yourself and Roy would say you believed in God?
Absolutely, yes. And Roy, before we got married, was confirmed. And so, yes, it was an important part of our lives in that sense.
Now, tell us about your children. You have four.
What
four are
they
children. Up to?
They're all older than I am now. My oldest was 47 this year, and I said, you can't be that old. I'm not that old yet. Isn't it sad? Aren't I a sad person, really? So Daniel's my oldest.
And where's Daniel?
He's a teacher.
Right.
Doesn't live far from home, from where I live. Which is lovely. Antonia is, Julia's next one down. I'll do it in order. Julia worked as a missionary in Peru for 12 years. And although she's home at the moment and has been probably for about 6 years, she and her husband, they plan to go back. So I don't know when that will be. And then Antonia works for the BBC. She's works backstage. She's what they call a floor manager. So she's like a stage manager in a theatre. She does all the backstage stuff. The moment she's doing Later with Jules Holland. Do you watch that programme? Late night music programme.
Right.
And then Benjamin, my youngest, is a professional musician.
Playing what instruments?
Bit of a chip off the old block, really, because he plays saxophone, clarinet, flute, drums, keyboards, you know.
Right.
I'll have a go at most things.
Okay. Now, you came to a time in your experience where all the glamour of what Roy was doing in your life, what you were doing, it began to collapse a little. Just tell us about that.
Yes, I probably was the most privileged person that you could possibly ever have met, because I had a wonderful husband who loved me, who provided for me. I was able to be a full-time mother. I didn't have to work outside the home in order to help to pay a mortgage. I had everything to make life comfortable, four beautiful, healthy children, lovely home and everything in it to make everything perfect, really. But the one person who wasn't perfect was me. And the trouble was, I think, when I look back, I realise I was a perfectionist. I wasn't perfect, you see. Trouble with being a perfectionist, I don't know if you realise this, is that you're always a failure, because you never match up to your own expectation of what that perfection should be. And I was always struggling and striving to be this perfect wife, mother, homemaker, hostess, whatever it took. And I always felt that I was a failure. And I'd look around at my friends and their mums at the school gate, and all the things that I was struggling to do well, they seemed to be doing well without any struggle at all. And, you know, whatever I tried to do, it never worked. And I'd see all my friends seemingly coping much better than I was. And I really wanted to be a good wife. I really wanted Roy to be glad that he'd married me, and, you know, I wanted him to realize that. And I just felt that I wasn't matching up all the time. I tried all sorts of things to make life work, and I always came back to this place of failure.
What age would you have been then, Fiona?
I was 35.
Did you know any Christians then?
Well, yes, because I went to church. So I did know lots of Christians, or so I thought. But, you know, at that particular time, although I would have called myself a Christian if you'd asked me, I was a churchgoer, and I think I followed a ritual. But Roy used to say, I don't know why you bother to go to church, because by the time you get your children in the car and get to church, you're in such a foul temper, it can't possibly do you any good. And he was absolutely right. You know, I would be screaming at the children and in a terrible mood and all the rest of it. And I'd go through the church door, on would go this mass. Good morning, everybody. What a delightful day it is today. I wonder how many of us do that, actually. Pretend all's well, because we don't want to let the side down. But inside, I was falling apart.
Did you meet anybody who helped you in that time, Fiona?
Well, one day it happened, because I began to feel that the world would be better off if I wasn't in it. I got that bad. And one morning, I went up to my bedroom after I'd taken the children to school, and I got down on my knees, and I just cried out to God. And I said, God, if you're there, you've got to help me, and you've got to help me now, because I've had it. I can't go on like this any longer. And that's all I said, but I don't honestly think I expected God to even hear me, let alone do anything about it, even if he was there. And I was beginning to wonder if it was all a load of rubbish, you know, and it was all in everybody's imagination. But God must have known that I meant business that day, because I hadn't even got up off my knees before the phone rang. And when I answered the phone, the person who was at the other end was somebody I'd met a couple of times. I certainly would never have expected her to phone me socially, but I did know she was a Christian. And she just said, Fiona, I don't know why I'm phoning you, but I've had you on my mind recently, and I had this sudden urge to ring you. she said, I feel as if you need to talk. I don't know why, and I don't know what you need to talk about, but would you like to come over and have a coffee with me and talk? Well, I had to recognize that as God's way of answering that desperate cry for help. So I went round to her house then and
that
there,
day?
That morning, within minutes. I was so desperate, and I was so convinced that this was, you know, more than a coincidence. Mm. And it was something that I desperately needed to do. So I dumped Benjamin, our baby, into Roy's arms and said, I'm going out, and left. And he told me later he thought that was it. I'd literally left him holding the baby and I was never coming back. He was probably quite glad about it, poor guy, because he had to put up with me and my moods for so long. But I went to this woman, and I think because I didn't know her very well, I was able to talk to her and offload on her. I would never have mentioned how I felt to a family member or a friend. I was far too proud. Mm. As I said, I always kept this mask in front of my face, pretending all was well. Mm. But I felt comfortable to let her listen to what I was going through, and she was a very good listener. And she heard me out. And then she asked me the most challenging question anybody's ever asked me in my life. She simply said, you know, Fiona, you think you're a Christian because you go to church, but have you ever invited Jesus to come in and take over your life? I said, no, I hadn't. Didn't realize you were supposed to. As far as I was aware, that wasn't in the Book of Common Prayer. You know, I thought I'd done all the things I was supposed to do by singing hymns and saying prayers and helping old ladies across the road. You know, that's how I thought it was all, you know, was going to work out. And she said, had I invited Jesus into my life? So when I said no, she said, well, don't you think it's about time you did? So I just said, yes. And I said yes, because I was afraid to say no. I didn't know what it would mean, but I thought possibly it would mean that I would never have to wear makeup anymore and put flat sandals and socks on or something, you know. All the ridiculous things you hear about Christians. But she told me that she'd suffered from depression for many years and that she'd taken that step herself and it had totally turned her life around. And I thought, well, if it's worked for her, it could work for me. I had nothing to lose and I could have something to gain. Mm. So with her help, I prayed a prayer to invite Jesus into my
life. That very day?
That very moment.
Do you remember what you said?
I do. I can never forget it. I just said, with her help, because I was not used to praying much without the use of a prayer book. Mm. Please, Jesus, forgive me for the mess I've made of my marriage, my life, my family up to this point. I recognize the way I've tried to run my life hasn't worked. So you come in and take it over and see what you can do with the rest of it. And he did, at that moment.
Did you feel any different?
I experienced peace flowing all over me and right through me, a peace that I'd never known was possible in the whole of my life up to that point. It was as if all the tension, anxiety and fear that had lived with me for most of my life, actually, I'd always been a very nervous, anxious person, it just seemed to melt away. And in place of it came this incredible peace. It was like somebody pouring healing oil all over me and right through me, touching all those hurting places of my life. And I just knew I was different. I wasn't sure why or how it would work out once I got home and back to reality. But I just had this incredible experience.
When you eventually went home, and Roy was still holding the baby,
poor guy.
Did he sort of spot you were different? Did he say anything? Did he intimate, Fiona, you're not quite as on edge or whatever? Or what panned out in the next few weeks?
Well, on the way home from that experience, God showed me in his wisdom that I shouldn't tell Roy anything that had happened. Can you imagine if I'd gone home? Oh, it's all right now, darling. I've become a Christian, so everything would be fine. Ha, ha, ha. He'd have done a runner himself because he thought, oh, she's got religious mania as well as everything else, you know, poor guy. But God showed me I had to live out what I'd discovered, not by telling him I was different, but by being different. So I didn't say a word, and neither did Roy. But later on, he told me that it was as if somebody had painted our house in 2 seconds flat. I'd gone out and it was all black and gloomy, come back in and it was all light and bright and sunny. But he thought it might just be a 5-minute wonder, so he didn't ask. And so eventually, after a few weeks, he started to ask me what had happened. Where did you go that day, and who did you speak to, and what's happened to you, and why are you being nice to me? And he said, so then when I told him, his answer was brilliant. He just said, oh, thank goodness. He said, I've been praying for years that you'd see the light and become a reasonable human being again. So I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, but I think Roy, all the way through, had had a very simple faith, and I'd come in and made it into a ritual for him without the reality. And when the reality hit, it hit him as well. And he said he'd seen such a change in me, and he had to run after me for 100 miles an hour to catch up. But he did, and it was wonderful from that. I mean, from the moment that I became a Christian, our marriage changed. See, God didn't change my circumstances. They remained the same. But he changed my attitude to those circumstances. It was as if I could stand back from the chaos that had been my life up to that point and see everything from God's point of view. What would God want me to do in this place? How should I respond? And I knew that so long as I was where God wanted me to be, doing what he wanted me to do, that would be my place of peace. And at that particular time, all he was calling me to be was wife and mum. And I'd been rushing around trying to fulfill so many other people's requests and, you know, trying to be helpful and useful and involved with all sorts of different charities and things. And I stopped all of that just in order to focus on what was really important at that particular time. And I maintain that right through to tonight. So long as I'm where God wants me to be, doing what he wants me to do, that's my place of peace.
And the issue about being a perfectionist is that though at one time you can't achieve, you can't quite achieve, so you're sort of on this treadmill, this gave you acceptance with God first, didn't it?
It did.
Did it help you to sort of accept yourself, Fiona?
Absolutely. I think so many of us are so worried about what other people think about us, aren't we? You know, we're trying to please everybody. And suddenly I didn't need to do that and not worry about what people thought about me. Roy actually had a wonderful expression. He said, do you know, from 20 to 30, we really worry about what people think about us. From 30 to 40, we don't worry quite so much. And from 40 onwards, we realize they weren't thinking about us anyway.
Quite a philosopher you're
well, it was, because, you know, we're all too worried about ourselves and wound up with our own problems to worry about other people. So, I mean, from that point of view, it was amazing. And I wasn't a perfectionist anymore. Things didn't get done, tough. And I was much more relaxed. And instead of trying to make a 5-course dinner for people when they came to our house for a meal, you know, I'd say, well, here's the bread and cheese, enjoy it, you know. And do you know, it's so much nicer to do that, to have something really simple so that you can sit around a table and not worry about it and everybody can relax and enjoy company rather than food. And do you know, I used to really try so hard to impress people. I never did. I never worked out, but I tried to impress with the food that I provided for them. But I was so exhausted with it all before the guests came that all I could think of, oh, I hope they go soon, you know, get it over and done with because I'm so tired. And what's the point of that? Isn't it much better to just do something simple and have people really relax and enjoy each other's company? So yeah, I wasn't a perfectionist anymore after that. You could come back to my flat now and run your finger along the windowsill and there'd be quite a layer of dust, but who cares? I'm hygienic, you know, try to be hygienic.
Just Fiona, in a moment or two, we're going to have refreshments and a little break for 15 minutes, and then we're going to take some questions from the floor after the break.
Okay.
Is that okay?
But you can get those questions.
But what we'll do is I'll just round off with one or two questions. I remember reading Roy's story, and eventually he was diagnosed with cancer. And I remember reading, well, what does one do when you're told this news? And he went on to sort of talk about, well, it makes you see life in a totally different colour. What age was he when he was diagnosed with cancer, and how long did he have cancer for?
He was about 59, I think, when he was diagnosed. And he was actually given 3 months to live, but he lived 2.5 years.
And
so he defied logic.
Was Roy's condition, was it a great shock to you, or did you suspect something, or how did that work out?
Well, by the time he was diagnosed, we were suspicious that it was something serious. But there had been some sort of rumour and rumble that the specialist had mentioned lung cancer. But we didn't take a lot of notice of it because Roy had never smoked. And we always associated up to that time lung cancer with smoking. Mm. So we just thought, no, there's going to be some other explanation for it. He'd had this virus that had really nearly killed him. It was a very serious virus. And I think what had happened was that it enabled the lung cancer cells that were already in his lung to actually burst forth, as it were.
The world that Roy moved in would have been the world of celebrities, and every day we can read about all sorts of stories and stupid things going on, and can we believe this, can we trust this, and what next? The great thought then was Roy had picked up this probably working in clubs and smoking environments. Would you say that was accurate?
Well, that's what they said, because his particular kind of lung cancer, different kinds of lung cancer, but his particular kind is only ever found in smokers, which is why they started to really look into passive smoking as a killer, rather than, you know, that when Roy first was told that it had to be through passive smoking, the general public just poo-pooed it and said, no, that's ridiculous. But of course, now we all know how dangerous it is. And one of the statistics is that if you smoke 20 cigarettes in a small situation, i.e. a car or a small room or something like that, the rest of the people who are there are effectively smoking 17 of those 20 cigarettes. That's how dangerous it is. Mm. And of course, you're breathing in the smoke that isn't filtered. And so it can be more dangerous. So, but in those days, I mean, those of you who are upper age group, it's nobody my age here, there was smoking, you know, there was a little ashtray behind every seat in a theatre. And I remember the smoke swirling through the spotlight onto the stage, and nobody thought anything about it. The same in the cinemas and so on, nobody realised how dangerous it was.
When Roy appreciated the seriousness of his condition, did he talk to you about your Christian faith, or did you have any good chats? Or because there was a deepening, if I'm not mistaken, in his own experience. So
absolutely, it was a very interesting time actually, because Roy came home to tell me the news quite late in the evening. He'd been meeting up with his specialist in the evening, and he was quite late coming back. And there was a lovely guy called Dave Foster who headed up a charity, and he was waiting with me for Roy to come back, because he'd asked Roy if he would do a voiceover for a charity video that he was making. And Roy had agreed, and I was having to entertain Dave and say, I'm really sorry he's so long, you know. Roy came in, told us both the news. Well, I've got lung cancer. It's the fastest growing kind of lung cancer. I've got 3 months without treatment, 6 months with treatment, and it's inoperable. Okay, Dave, let's go and get that video done. And left me turned to lead in my kitchen, thinking, what is going on? And so I prayed, God, what are you doing? What is happening? And it was almost as if I heard an audible voice saying, stand back and see what I'm going to do through this. And suddenly I realized God hadn't abandoned us, He still loved us. He knew what was going on. And all he was asking us to do was to allow him to work through the circumstances we found ourselves in at that time. And suddenly it all went back to normal. Oh, God's in this. We're okay. And trusting him through the tough times as we trusted him in the good times. And we had so many opportunities to share our faith as a result of what happened. Now, you referred to Roy as a celebrity. In those days, there weren't the celebrities that we have all these years later. Roy did a job of work that he loved doing, and he was so grateful that he could earn a living doing something he loved, and that was the bottom line of it. And we'd always lived such ordinary lives that the press had left us totally alone. So it never even occurred to us that we'd get a lot of publicity, or Roy would get a lot of publicity for this. But it happened, because about 2 weeks into Roy's treatment, somebody must have told the press, and they were phoning me all the way through the night, the press. And I thought, oh, well, I'll tell them the truth, but there'll be three lines at the bottom of the newspaper the next day, end of story. I had to go out the following morning, came back in at lunchtime, and there was a row of cars down our street, got to the back door, and there was a row of photographers and reporters standing outside the back door. So I said, what are you all doing standing outside? And one of them said, oh, Roy will only let us in five at a time. How many chairs have we got in our sitting room, you know? Anyway, I said, come in and I'll make you a cup of coffee till Roy's ready for you, see. And there was a sink full of dirty coffee cups. So I knew that poor Roy had been looking after them all morning. When the last ones had gone, Roy just turned to me and said, well, he said, I don't know what they're going to put in the papers, but he said, I've told them all about Jesus. And I went, what? Now, Roy had always been very open about his faith, and he'd always lived it out in the workplace, but he hadn't sort of been very articulate about it because he didn't want to be seen as a nutcase. He wanted people to see the reality of it. And he said, yes, he said, I've got a platform now. He said, if my faith hadn't been real, it would have gone out of the window with the when I got cancer. But he said, it's more real to me now than it's ever been. So they can't deny it. And I have to speak as I find, and the press were wonderful to us all the way through.
And was it just a few lines, or was it bigger?
I think it was bigger than that. And it never stopped right through to his death. It was really interesting. I just thought the public would be fed up to the back teeth of all of it, you know, but it just went on right through till after he died.
Fiona, we are going to have a break, but fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
We'll take 15 minutes and then Simon will shout us back and questions from the floor.
So, all right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, sir.